Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Foreign ministers from Iran and major world powers will convene in Vienna Saturday for talks on Tehran's nuclear program after going past yet another deadline to reach a comprehensive deal. British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond.
We're making progress. It's painfully slow, as you will have observed over the last week, but we are making progress. There are still some issues that have to be resolved.
Lower-level officials from the U.S., Britain, and other participants in the talks are still meeting with Iran's team, Hammond indicated, and said he is very confident they will make some progress toward the wording of a final agreement. Hammond said he and other foreign ministers would regroup in Vienna Saturday to see whether we can get over the remaining hurdles. Hopes in stocks are rising across Europe that a package of reforms proposed by Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras will pass muster. Lisa Bryant has more from Paris.
French President François Hollande offered an early and strong endorsement of the reforms tabled by the Greek government late Thursday, reportedly with some help from France.
Les Grecs viennent de montrer une détermination.
Mr. Hollande described the Greek proposals as serious and credible, saying they demonstrated the country's determination to remain part of the euro currency union.
Uitgebreid stuk tekst. Maar de kwaliteit ervan moet echt nog goed worden bekeken.
Dutch finance minister and Eurogroup head Jeroen Dijsselbloem described the package as a comprehensive text, but did not comment on its content. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
This is VOA News coming to you from Washington, D.C. Pope Francis is wrapping up his pilgrimage to Bolivia with a visit Friday to the violent and overcrowded Palmasola prison. Palmasola is the most notorious of Bolivia's 32 prisons, built to hold about 800 people, but housing 5,000. 2 years ago, 36 people died in a fierce battle between rival gangs. Bolivia has a notoriously corrupt judiciary with some 1,000 judges and 300 prosecutors under investigation or on trial for corruption. On Thursday, the Pope spoke out against corporate greed and apologized for colonialism in the Americas in a speech to groups working for the unemployed, the landless, and the impoverished. The U.S. Office of Personnel Management now says hackers have stolen sensitive information involving 21.5 million people from federal government databases. The scope of the data breach, believed to be the biggest in U.S. history, has grown dramatically since the government first disclosed earlier this year that hackers had gotten into OPM's personnel database and stolen the records of about 4.2 million people. A second incident, OPM said, involved 19.7 million people. An honor guard from the South Carolina Highway Patrol has taken down the Confederate flag that has flown on the grounds of the southern U.S. state capitol for more than 50 years. A biracial crowd of hundreds cheered and chanted USA, USA Friday as they witnessed the flag's historic removal from the statehouse grounds, a day many in the state thought would never come. The move comes 3 weeks after the racially inspired murders of 9 African-American church members in Charleston, South Carolina. The flag's removal comes one day after Governor Nikki Haley signed a bill supported by Democrats and Republicans removing the Civil War-era flag. Lawmakers in South Carolina's House of Representatives followed the state Senate when they passed the bill after more than 13 hours of emotional debate. The head of the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation, James Comey, said Thursday agents broke up a number of terror plots in the weeks leading up to the Independence Day holiday. I do believe our work had disrupted efforts to kill people, likely in connection with July 4th, Comey told reporters. He said more than 10 people were arrested, but he gave no more information. European aircraft manufacturer Airbus flew its electric plane across the English Channel for the first time Friday, less than 24 hours after a private pilot achieved the feat. Pilot Didier Estinier took off from Nide, England, bound for Calais, France, early Friday, and arrived 37 minutes later. The 6-meter-long EFAN electric plane operates exclusively on batteries, and since there's no oil or water, it had released zero emissions. I'm Bob Doty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Thank you.
Good evening and welcome to African News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib, and coming up this hour on African News Tonight.
The strategy to end the outbreak is working, but the final stretch of the response remains particularly challenging. Cases in Guinea and Sierra Leone have been reduced considerably. New cases in Liberia show the need for continued vigilance, given the regional risk.
That's UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon addressing the International Ebola Recovery Conference in New York. Details coming up.
Also, the flood of migrants to Europe continues to grow in the Eastern Mediterranean, and the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights warns Burundi's presidential election next week could explode and lead to regional instability.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ghana, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on African News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the UN Secretary General's Ebola Recovery Conference opened today. The summit aims to raise funding to rebuild the health systems of Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. The presidents of those Ebola-hit nations are addressing the conference, as are the World Bank president and chairperson of the African Union, President Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe. Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf spoke to the economic struggles of the three Manu River Union countries over the past year. The economies had been rebounding from long years of regional strife, but in 2014, the price for exports declined, and the worst was yet to come: the spread of the deadly Ebola virus.
With the onslaught of the Ebola virus disease, the challenges quickly became a national and sub-regional crisis of unprecedented proportions. Our health systems collapsed. Contractors, consultants, and investors left our countries. Farms and markets ceased. Trade and travel contracted. Fiscal balances weakened, revenue declined, and expenditure increased largely on health operations. Moreover, in 2014, our economies contracted and projected growth declined from 4.5% to 1.3% in Guinea, 11.3% to 6% in Sierra Leone, and 5.9% to 0.4% in Liberia. As national governments and as sub-region, we took the challenge head-on, making difficult decisions that ran contrary to long-standing tradition, mobilizing the international community to recognize the disease as a global threat, organizing our best technical professionals to oversee our respective disease management systems, and more importantly, empowering our communities who were determined to protect their lives and their livelihoods.
Today, the situation has improved and Ebola is nearly gone from the region. The Liberian president says recovery will mean rebuilding healthcare, education systems, water sanitation, and getting economic growth back on track. It will also include assistance to agriculture and cash transfers for those at the lowest level of subsistence. The plan will encourage psychiatric services for communities and individuals recovering from the outbreak, and it will aim to reopen the trade between the neighboring nations upon which women traders depend.
In furtherance of this goal, the third extraordinary summit of the Manu River Union held in Conakry on the 28th of June 2015 adopted the sub-regional post-Ebola socio-economic recovery program. The priorities and costs of the sub-regional Ebola recovery program, as well as the institutional and financing framework to ensure effective implementation. The sub-regional plan is clustered into two levels. Level one is estimated at US $1.76 billion, focusing on health, water, sanitation and hygiene. 2, governance, peace and security. 3, agriculture, fisheries and food security. 4, gender, youth and social protection. 5, program management and monitoring. And 6, private sector development. Level 2 is estimated at US $2.24 billion, focusing on 1, regional roads, energy access, and information and communication technology. In terms of the institutional and financing framework to ensure effective implementation, we have decided to establish a single Mono River Union Consolidated Ebola Recovery Trust Fund with allocation and disbursement arrangements to be determined by the MRU countries in consultation with partners.
And the chairman of the African Union, President Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe, also addressed the conference. He commended the AU for its support in assisting the Manu River countries during the crisis.
Let me take this opportunity to acknowledge and commend the African Union and the African Union Commission for their sterling leadership role in the fight against the Ebola scourge, principally through the African Union support to Ebola outbreak in West Africa, working through ASIOA, which is the outbreak in West Africa. The African Union has overseen the release of funds to the Special Emergency Fund for Drought and Famine in Africa to help the affected countries. It has also mobilized the private sector, which has contributed up to $32,600,000 to the Ebola Fund. In addition to the above initiatives, and in the spirit of Africa taking a leadership role in addressing its own challenges, the African Union will convene an international conference on Ebola in Malabo, Equatorial Guinea, from the 20th to the 21st of July this year.
President Mugabe called for the maximum engagement of the international community in support of the effort to curb Ebola and to rebuild Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. He said, as long as Ebola is not contained in West Africa, the interconnected world is threatened by potential outbreaks. As President Sirleaf told the delegates to the conference, viruses, like terrorism, knows no national boundaries.
The finance ministers of Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea addressed the Ebola Recovery Conference last night in New York. They are seeking more than $3 billion to rebuild their health systems and sustain an economic recovery. Dr. David Nabarro, the UN Special Envoy on Ebola, said recovery itself means the recovery of the people at the community level and the recovery of nations. VOA's Jackson Mvunganyi covered last night's presentation of the finance leaders' recovery strategy, and he provided me with insight into the plan and what it will cost.
Well, the strategy really wants to move from just responding to emergencies related to Ebola to more stronger resilience and recovery of their communities. And they have a couple of areas that they're targeting, including education, social protection, but most importantly, private sector growth. You know that the economies of these three countries were highly affected by Ebola. There's been slow economic growth up to almost 0% in the last year because of Ebola. There has been a decrease in cross-border trade. All these countries kind of depend on each other. They're hoping that they can secure up to $3.2 billion to inject into their economies onto these targeted areas of health, of education, social protection, and private sector growth.
Also, did they talk about any specific lessons learned from the Ebola crisis?
You can tell that they land not to be in a position where they have to continually respond to emergencies, but to kind of be ready. That means having strong health systems that can respond to emergencies. That means they have facilities and hospitals that can admit and take care of patients, having doctors that are ready and prepared and have the tools to be able to respond to emergencies related to Ebola. Those are some of the critical lessons they learned. They also learned the importance of collaboration, because it's very important given that all these three countries, or at least the whole of West Africa, is kind of interconnected in many ways. There's a lot of cross-border movement, cross-border trade. They learned the importance of collaboration. No one country is isolated. If Ebola is in Liberia, it's obviously going to find somewhere to cross over to Sierra Leone or to any other country in the neighborhood.
Also, the UN Special Envoy on Ebola, Dr. David Nabarro, also spoke last night as well. And he mentioned one of the things in terms of lessons learned was that recovery itself means the recovery of the people at the community level.
Right. He says that it starts from the community level all the way to the national level. And that if we're going to invest in recovery in these countries, that money has to go to filter down all the way to the community. In education, for example, communities about their barrier methods. We know that many of these countries have had issues. One of the main reasons why there's been a high rates of Ebola in many of these places is because of some of these traditional methods of barrier. And so if you're going to tackle the issue, it has to go all the way to the community, sensitize the community about some of these unsafe practices that lead to contracting Ebola. It means that you have clinics or dispensaries at the community level that will respond effectively to any emergencies where people have contracted Ebola, instead of waiting to take them to, say, the national hospital in the capital city, that there's a response mechanism at the local level where people can be treated.
In addition, the three finance ministers also are seeking up to $3.2 billion to rebuild their health systems and sustain recovery. Is this a realistic request for the international community?
I get the feeling, or I get the sense, that they don't expect to get all the money, all the $3.2 billion in the next 24 months, because that's the time frame that they're hoping that this $3.2 billion can be used to fill some of those gaps. But they feel that it's very important that to secure some of those pledges from the international community to fill some of their technical and financial gaps, and also to implement the recovery strategies. Whether they will get the money, all of it, I'm not sure. But they're hoping that to convince the international community, all the donor community or the member countries, the UN international community members who will be at the conference today, to understand the impact or the importance of responding, of pledging, because Ebola is not something that affects only one country or one region. You know, given the travels from one area to the other, we've had cases here in the U.S. of people who traveled from Sierra Leone and other West African countries coming in. We've had the same cases in Europe. So there's an understanding that if we don't treat this at the source, if we don't respond and help these countries, that somehow Western countries are not safe in themselves.
That's VOA's Jackson Mvungani speaking from the UN International Ebola Recovery Conference in New York City.
And meanwhile, the World Bank warns the Ebola deaths of hundreds of healthcare workers could cause maternal mortality rates to soar in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. The disease has killed health workers at a higher rate than any other population group. VOA's Jody Kapowa reports.
A World Bank report says maternal deaths could reach levels not seen in the Ebola-affected countries in 15 or 20 years. Rates could increase by 38% in Guinea, 74% in Sierra Leone, and 111% in Liberia. Senior economist and co-author of the report, David Evans, reacts to those figures.
What this adds up to is, between both mothers and children, about 25,000 lost lives per year.
This could happen, he says, because Ebola has taken such a toll on health workers.
The Ebola epidemic has had a dramatically disproportionate impact on health workers in these three countries, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea. For example, in Sierra Leone, health workers have been 50 times more likely to contract Ebola than the rest of the population, and the numbers are similar in the other two countries.
Evans says the three countries were already fragile before Ebola struck, because they had what he calls an incredibly limited healthcare force.
before the Ebola epidemic, Sierra Leone was fifth from the bottom globally in terms of doctors per capita. Liberia was second from the bottom. And Guinea was 28th, which is a little better, but still not a very strong health workforce. So you start from that, and then you take away between 5 and 10% of their healthcare workforce.
Liberia, for example, lost 10% of its doctors. It only had 51 prior to the outbreak. Many have raised concerns that during the Ebola epidemic, children did not receive measles vaccinations. Malaria and HIV/AIDS patients failed to get treatment, and testing for HIV plummeted.
One of the things that we noticed is that nobody was really focusing on specifically this loss of health workers, which actually has a whole range of effects, including the most fundamental outcomes in the health sector, like maternal and infant mortality.
But the World Bank report, Healthcare Worker Mortality and the Legacy of the Ebola Epidemic, says all is not lost. Evans says something can be done immediately to keep things from getting worse.
In the immediate run, we need to make sure that there are plenty of health workers right now that are available. And so one of the solutions to that, which the World Bank and a number of other international partners, the UN, the African Union, have been supporting the recruitment, training, and deployment of foreign health workers to communities in need in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. So about 1,300 have been deployed so far. So in the short run, this is crucial.
The senior economist says, however, a long-term solution is a necessity.
It means investing in the local healthcare infrastructure, making sure that doctors, nurses, midwives, and community health workers are trained and that they have the protection that they need to do their jobs safely, and that they have the pay that they need so that they're willing to stay in country. There are a lot of local professionals who want to serve their home population if they can do so in reasonable conditions and with some level of reasonable remuneration.
The World Bank report says to reach 80% health coverage included in the Millennium Development Goals, more than 43,000 doctors, nurses, and midwives would have to be hired across Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. The World Bank study was published in The Lancet Global Health. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib. 23 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The UN Secretary General's Ebola Recovery Conference opened today in New York. The summit aims to raise funding to rebuild the health systems of Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. And according to the World Bank, Ebola has killed health workers at a higher rate than any other population group. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The flood of migrants to Europe continues to grow and shift to the eastern Mediterranean. As Greece struggles with a grave financial crisis, 1,000 refugees a day are landing on its islands in the Aegean Sea. Greek villages are running out of supplies for the refugees escaping conflict, violence, and poverty in Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and several African countries. William Spindler is a spokesman for the UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR. From Geneva, he spoke to VOA's David Arnold about the refugee crisis in the Aegean.
Since the beginning of the year, the number of refugees arriving on the Greek islands has increased dramatically. At the moment, about 1,000 refugees are arriving every single day on the Greek islands. This is putting huge strain on scarce resources and infrastructure of these islands. Despite all the efforts of the local authorities and the local communities, they are not longer able to cope with these arrivals. And we are urging Europe to come to the aid of Greece because otherwise the situation will deteriorate even further.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the economic issues, particularly on these islands with these little towns that have been trying to cope with the increase in refugees?
Well, these are small island communities that are ill-equipped to deal with such a large influx of arrivals. The facilities there for the local people are very reduced, and they are overwhelmed by the number of people arriving. If you just take hospitals and clinics, for example, now many of these facilities have to deal with people arriving with bullet wounds from the war in Syria, for instance, or with chronic diseases, or people who are exhausted after crossing by sea from Turkey. And there are cases of pregnant women, for instance, arriving as well that need to be taken to hospital. And the local health facilities are not coping. You can say the same about accommodation, about the provision of food and drinking water, sanitation. So basically, these islands are being overrun. So we take into account the present economic situation in Greece with the debt crisis, the closure of banks and so on. You can imagine difficulties that communities are facing at the moment.
How do the refugees make their way from the islands to the mainland and then on to Macedonia?
When they land on the islands, the refugees are registered by the local police, and it's only after they have been registered and fingerprinted and identified that they are allowed to continue with their journeys. Until that moment, they are technically in an irregular or illegal situation because they have entered Greece without proper documentation. They need to be registered by the police, and this is what is causing a backlog. But once they are registered, they are given a document by the police that allows the refugees to buy their own ticket and to travel from these islands onto the mainland of Greece. And from there, they continue their journeys through Macedonia and Serbia to Hungary and from there to the rest of Europe.
Have there been any reports about efforts to prevent refugees from crossing national borders?
We are very worried about some reports that we have received about some instances of violence against refugees on the border between Serbia and Macedonia, and also at the borders between Macedonia and Greece. In some cases that have been reported to us, refugees have alleged that force has been used against them and that they have been pushed back. Many countries in the Balkans and in Central Europe are responding to this situation by tightening their borders and by building walls and fences, such as the one planned between Hungary and Serbia. In our view, this is not the solution. We are appealing to Europe to step up its response and to deal with this emergency that is happening at its doorstep.
That was William Spindler of the UN Refugee Agency talking to VOA's David Arnold. In related news, Poland offered yesterday to take 2,000 refugees during a meeting of EU ministers in Luxembourg.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Yisuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
This is a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
Ebola is not a curse or spiritual infection. It is a deadly disease, a fever spread by contact with the body fluids of infected people. I am Dr. Kande Greaves. If symptoms start with a fever, fatigue, and muscle pain, within a few days, vomiting and diarrhea sets in, and victims lose about 4 liters of body fluid each day. Ebola is highly infectious. If you experience any of these symptoms, seek medical help immediately. You must wash your hands regularly. Do not eat or handle bushmeat. Stay away from people suffering from Ebola. And do not handle the bodies of Ebola victims. If you have had contact with someone who has Ebola, you need to have your temperature monitored daily for any change. Early diagnosis and treatment is critical to your survival. Learn the facts about Ebola. Knowledge is life.
This was a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Ebola has killed health workers at a higher rate than any other population group. The flood of migrants to Europe continues to grow and shift to the eastern Mediterranean. And coming up, we'll have music from Ghana. And in our feature segment, Somalia remains one of the most dangerous countries for a journalist. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Buhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Friday, Sunny.
Happy Friday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand that Wimbledon tennis topped your sports report today.
Kim, my opening serve on the Sunny Side of Sports is once again Wimbledon tennis. Defending champion Novak Djokovic of Serbia advanced once again to the final on Friday, defeating Frenchman Richard Gasquet in straight sets 7-6, 6-4, and 6-4. In a match that lasted 2 hours and 21 minutes, the top-ranked Djokovic survived some fabulous tennis from Gasquet in the opening set when the French player executed some brilliant backhands. In the first set tiebreaker, Djokovic won 7-2 and then controlled the next two sets. Speaking immediately after his win, the Joker described his performance as very good considering the occasion, and he praised Gasquet for having a great tournament. The Serbian star is now within one victory of his third Wimbledon title and the ninth Grand Slam singles title of his career. He'll play the winner of Friday's second semifinal between Roger Federer of Switzerland and Andy Murray of Britain for the trophy on Sunday. Federer has won Wimbledon 7 times, with his last triumph in 2012 when he beat Murray in 4 sets in the final. The Swiss maestro has won 17 Grand Slam singles titles, the most by any men's player. For his part, Andy Murray has 2 major titles to his credit, Wimbledon in 2013 and the U.S. Open in 2012. Meanwhile, the ladies' singles final at Wimbledon will be Saturday. Top-ranked Serena Williams of the USA bidding for her 6th Wimbledon championship and 21st Grand Slam title is a big favorite against Spain's Garbiñe Muguruza, who is playing in her first major final. Serena reminded reporters at Wimbledon, though, the 21-year-old Spaniard did beat her in the second round of last year's French Open.
Yeah, well, it's definitely not an easy matchup. She actually has a win against me, and we had a tough match the last time we played. So, and she's given me problems in the past. So this time I have to just, you know, go in it, like have fun and do the best that I can and just try to stay positive and stay focused.
If Serena stays positive and stays focused, I think there's a very good chance she'll be lifting the trophy high at Wimbledon once again on Saturday. And if that's the case, Serena will hold all 4 Grand Slam trophies simultaneously and be within one title, the U.S. Open, of a calendar year Grand Slam. Here's a Sunny Side of Sports salute to Eritrean cyclist Daniel Tekle-Haimanot, who pedaled past another major milestone Thursday at the Tour de France. The 26-year-old rider had already made Tour de France history as part of the first African-registered team ever to compete in cycling's most famous event. And on Thursday, Daniel made more history. He became the first African to don the polka dot jersey awarded to the race's leading climber. David gave a thumbs up after winning the King of the Mountains classification. Daniel described it as a childhood dream come true, getting the polka dot jersey at the Tour de France. Daniel also said it's a big step forward for African cycling. It also marks a big win for the South Africa-based team MTN
Kubeka, which, like Daniel Tekla Haimanot, is bidding for the competing, I should say, for the first time in the Tour de France. Well, celebrations and parades are taking place here in the United States this week for the World Cup winning U.S. women's national soccer team. Thousands of fans cheered for the American women Friday at a ticker tape parade in New York City. The USA won its record third World Cup title July 5th in Vancouver, Canada, where they dethroned defending champion Japan 5-2 in the final. The American women will be traveling to different parts of the United States during their victory tour. In this encore Sunny Side of Sports presentation, let's take a look back at the USA's big trophy-winning victory over the Japanese. The Americans exploded for four goals during the first 16 minutes of the game. USA captain Carly Lloyd was the player of the match and the player of the tournament. She received the Golden Ball Award given to the best player at the Women's World Cup. After some hat-trick heroics in Vancouver, Carly scored three goals in the first half, finding the net in the third, fifth, and 16th minutes. Lloyd's third goal was my favorite. She dodged a challenge near the center circle, and near midfield, she noticed Japan's goalkeeper, Ayumi Kaori, was at the top of the penalty box. Lloyd launched a wonder strike as Kaori backpedaled, stumbled, and got a hand on it before watching the spectacular shot touch the post and roll into the net. Hey, Carly, how does it feel to be a World Cup champion?
I don't think it's entirely sunk in. I'm so proud and so zapped at the same time. It's a surreal moment. It's been amazing. I mean, we just wrote history today and brought this World Cup trophy home, which is unbelievable. But at the end of the day, you know, I think that I've pushed on my status a little bit and I have to stay up here. So it's not right away, but I'll be back to work and back stronger than ever.
As Carly Lloyd said, the USA wrote history with its third Women's World Cup title. The Americans also won the trophy in 1991 and 1999. They also gained a measure of revenge after losing to the Japanese on penalty kicks in the 2011 final. At the post-match news conference, U.S. coach Jill Ellis praised their Asian opponent.
First, I want to congratulate Japan. They are a tremendous opponent and deserving of always ending up in championship matches. Love how they play.
USA coach Jill Ellis talked with Abby Wambach, one of the greatest female soccer players ever, about taking on a different role at this World Cup. The 35-year-old Wambach came off the bench as a second-half substitute in both the semifinals and final. In the end, Wambach celebrated her first World Cup title.
I'm so happy. I'm emotionally exhausted, physically exhausted. I love my teammates. Carly Lloyd, are you kidding me with the effort that she gave today? But really, it was a true team effort. Not only just the 23 players, but our staff. It just shows how important every little detail has become.
And speaking of details, let's give a few details now on the award winners at this seventh Women's World Cup in Canada. Carly Lloyd, as I mentioned, won the Golden Ball Award as the best player in the month-long tournament. Lloyd also tied with Germany's Celia Sasic as the top scorer at the Women's World Cup. Each had six goals. Sasic, though, was awarded the Golden Boot based on playing fewer minutes than Lloyd. The Golden Glove Award for top goalkeeper went to American Hope Solo. 19-year-old defender Kadisha Buchanan of Host Canada won the Young Player Award, and the FIFA Fair Play Trophy went to France. In the third-place match at the Women's World Cup, England defeated Germany 1-0 in extra time in Edmonton, Canada. Farrah Williams scored on a penalty kick in the 108th minute for the three Lionesses of England, who had their best-ever Women's World Cup showing. For reaction, I'm joined by VOA's Tadi Abedje. Sporty greetings, Tadi.
Sporty greetings, Sonny.
Toddy, what did you think of that final in Vancouver?
It was a great final that the USA won, their third World Cup. They're the first team in World Cup history to win three World Cups in the Women's World Cup. And it's great that they got their revenge on Japan.
It seems like Carly Lloyd, you mentioned her as sort of the engine of that USA team. She does it again in the final.
She did it again. She's the first player in World Cup final history to record a hat trick, which means that she scored three goals, especially one of her goals scoring from midfield.
Toddy, do you feel like the American women have reestablished their dominance of women's football in the wake of that victory?
At least for 1 year. Can they do it for the next couple World Cups? Well, it remains to be seen.
On that note, it seems like the field is narrowing the gap when it comes to women's football, that some of these unheralded teams are really starting to make inroads.
Yeah, it is. It is. But the U.S. Came out on top because they had the best defense in the tournament.
Hope Solo.
Hope Solo was the best goalie of the tournament. And then the best player of the tournament was Carly Lloyd.
And who were some of the other key players, in your opinion, for the American women, Toddy, in addition?
The other key players, well, although Abby Wambach didn't play that much, but she gave them moral support.
And what's next? I mean, will it be the Olympics now? I guess the U.S. will look towards Rio.
Next year's Olympics, 2016. Most of the team could be playing in the Olympics. Oh, I don't know. I'm not sure about Abby Wambach. This probably is her last World Cup.
Yeah, I think maybe Abby might hang up her boots after this one. What a way to go out.
What a great way to go out her career. But it would be nice if she scored a goal in the final. it would be way too good to be true.
And it seems like the U.S. has sort of an affinity for playing the Japanese. They lost to them in the 2011 final. Then they beat them at the Olympics. And now they're back again at the
yes.
World Cup.
Revenge is sweet.
Overall, Toddy, what did you think of that tournament in Canada, the month-long tournament?
The tournament was great. It was great. Some people picked Germany to go all the way, but the U.S. defeated them 2-0. And the U.S. went all the way because of their defense and Carly Lloyd.
There we go. A shout-out for Carly Lloyd. A shout-out for Toddy Abeje.
Yes.
Thank you, Toddy.
Thank you, Sonny.
All right. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOASunny. And my Twitter handle is @VOASunnySports. Patrick Ogo sent me a tweet from Benin City, Nigeria. Patrick writes, "It's always a pleasure to listen to the Sunny Side of Sports." Well, Patrick, it's always a pleasure to read tweets like that. Thank you, buddy. I'm VOA Sonny Young. Thank you, Toddy Abeje. And that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahya's Wuheeb and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And thank you, Toddy. And thanks for all the excitement. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And today's Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, a report on hard-to-detect illnesses. And next, Somalia remains one of the most dangerous countries for a journalist. But first, some music. Here is Roki Duwani of Ghana with The Master Plan.
Celebrate this great promise of a brand new day.
people, lift up your heart. Oh. Now that you have seen the light, oh, we must sing this song with one great voice. Surviving the master plan. Surviving, surviving now. Come on, people, meditate, go higher. Ghana people, make you take you go higher. Come Africa, make you light my fire. And I'll be proud. I could not believe the news today. Another hero falls in South Africa. Wipe your tears and fears away. Sing new songs of joy and redemption. Oh. Wave your flags in celebration. Oh. Come on, people, lift up your heart. Oh. Now that you have seen the light, oh, we must sing this song with one great voice. Surviving the master plan. Surviving, surviving now. Surviving, surviving now.
If we fit to do our soul, then we do we go to our table higher.
Rocky Duwani of Ghana with the master plan.
Well, diseases that easily spread between people often make the headlines, like HIV/AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. What are also lethal but less talked about are what are known as non-communicable diseases, like heart disease, diabetes, or cancers. From Harare, Zimbabwe, Tatenda Gumbo reports about some of these hard-to-detect illnesses.
An estimated 31% of deaths in Zimbabwe in 2014 were a result of non-communicable diseases, World Health Organization statistics show. Private practitioner and former chair of the Zimbabwe Association of Doctors for Human Rights, Douglas Gwatidzo, explains NCDs.
NCDs are those conditions or diseases that do not spread through, like, for example, what we call droplet infection, where somebody coughs up some stuff which is loaded with bacteria and then it's passed on to another person.
What they are, explains Dr. Gwatidzo, are the equally dangerous but sometimes harder to detect diseases.
What we call cardiovascular disease, which is those diseases that affect mostly the heart. Then you can have other conditions that hormone-controlled conditions like diabetes. And then you could have a variety of cancers that are also not communicable, that just, you know, come up. But the word of caution, some cancers have what we call pre-exposing factors that are of an infective nature.
According to statistics, cardiovascular diseases like heart attacks and strokes account for 9% of deaths from NCDs, while 10% of these deaths are a result of cancer illnesses. Among this group of infectious cancers, says Dr. Anne Kaparau, a cancer specialist, is cervical cancer and other types which she says are closely linked to HIV.
And these include cervical cancer, Kaposi sarcoma, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and eye cancer. So the burden of cancer has been increased by the HIV disease.
Efforts to stop the spread of such cancers that come from contact are vaccines. As Dr. Bernard Madzima explains, efforts are underway to tackle the human papilloma virus, or HPV.
The most important thing is maybe to prevent and then to detect early. We're piloting what is called the human papilloma virus vaccine, which we're going to be giving to 9 to 13-year-old girls to pilot in two districts, Bedbridge and Sekou District.
While reports indicate an increase in such NCDs, Dr. Gwatizo says the level of awareness is now more than likely as a result of better detection as more people are diagnosed or find access to medical facilities.
I don't think there is an increase per se, an increase just like that. I don't think there is an element of increased pickup rates, increased awareness, and increased access to healthcare, which is making it possible for us to know that somebody will die of this condition.
Health professionals stress prevention as the best way to avoid getting illnesses that are communicable, like HIV, and also non-communicable, such as heart disease and diabetes, both of which are triggered by poor lifestyle habits, such as a poor diet and lack of exercise.
And when it comes to diet, I would advise people to avoid fast food as much as possible. I know it's very easy to get that kind of food. And just avoid the fast food and eat a lot of vegetables. The recommended portions in a normal dish is half the plate should be made of vegetables, and a quarter should be starch and a quarter protein. So if you stick to that kind of diet, you decrease the chances of you having too many calories in your body.
Further, says Dr. Gwatizo, a factor concern with the NCDs is that they are hereditary.
In other words, you're saying if one parent had or one relative had the condition, so chances of the sibling or the children getting that condition is high. But of course, you do get the odd one that comes out of the blue, where you try to trace as far back, in fact, 10 generations, and you don't find anybody. That you find in diabetes, and it's quite common. And some cancers also, you can't get cancers when there's no intervention.
Dr. Gwatizo says offsetting diabetes, heart disease, or even strokes can be fun, involving a little music and dancing.
If you're one of those that you've got access to these groups, exercise activities that happen, like walkathon, where people get together and just walk 10 kilometers and beyond. Or, like aerobathon, which is, you do aerobics, dancing to some music, which is fun together with exercise. If one can join such a club, that would be a great deal.
This is Tatenda Gumbo in Washington.
Despite improving security in the last few years, Somalia remains one of the most dangerous countries for a journalist. It's even more risky for a reporter who cannot see. Abdulaziz Billo has the story of a journalist, Abdul Fatah Hassan Kalgakal, who has been reporting from the Somali capital for the last decade, despite being blind.
Abdul Fatah Hassan, a visually impaired reporter, has defied the odds in a country ranked among the deadliest for journalists. He works at one of Mogadishu's leading radio stations. His friends and colleagues call him Kalgaal.
I had an eye illness at a very young age, but I couldn't get proper medical treatment due to the situation in Somalia. After the civil war started, I lost all hope of ever seeing again and had no medical support.
Despite the massive challenges, Kalgaal persevered and now works at Gobjok radio station as its senior reporter covering the Somali parliament. He also has a weekly program for handicapped people called The State of the Disabled. The live call-in show is popular, focusing on empowering the disabled by educating them on their basic rights.
I hope to use my position in the media to be a voice of the people and improve the humanitarian situation.
He hopes his message will resonate beyond Somalia's borders. Speaking 2 years ago at a technology, entertainment and design event, a global non-profit group to promote cultural understanding, Kalgaal described his journey from being born to a poor family in southern Somalia to becoming a husband, a father and journalist despite his visual impairment. He says many people advised him against pursuing such a dangerous career, but he says it was his childhood dream, and being sightless doesn't make him any more or any less vulnerable than other journalists. The key, he said, to overcoming his challenges was a belief in himself, the support of his friends and family, and bosses willing to employ him for his skills and overlook his disability. Abdulaziz Bilal for VOA News, Mogadishu.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
An international public service announcement by the United States government.
In another sign of the United States' determination to help the nations of Africa combat terrorism, millions of dollars in rewards are being offered for information on several top leaders of the Al-Qaeda-linked Somalia-based terrorist organization Harakat Shabab al-Mujahideen, or Al-Shabaab. The group, listed as a foreign terrorist organization since 2008, is battling that nation's government for control of Somalia and has also carried out a string of attacks in Kenya, most recently at a college in the town of Garissa. It is responsible for the deaths of thousands of Somali civilians, peace activists, international aid workers, journalists, and civilians, as well as African Union peacekeepers who are helping to restore stability and prosperity to the region. Tens of thousands of people have been forced to flee their homes amid the fighting. Under the terrorist designation, the United States imposed financial and other restrictions on the group, blocking property and prohibiting U.S. persons from engaging in transactions with its members. Now the U.S. is offering rewards for information leading to the location of six of its leaders. Rewards of up to $5 million each are offered for information on the location of Ibrahim Haji Jama, also known as Abu Zalma, Fuad Muhammad Khalaf, a dual Somali and Swedish national, also known as Fuad Shungala, Bashir Mohammed Mahmoud, an al-Shabaab military commander believed to have been born between 1979 and 1982, and Mukhtar Robo, a 43-year-old who has served as an al-Shabaab spokesman and who carries an Eritrean passport. Rewards of up to $3 million each are offered for information on the location of two additional al-Shabaab leaders, Abdullahi Yare and the group's intelligence chief, Zakaria Ismail Ahmed Hersi, also known as Zaki Madobi. The United States guarantees all credible reports will be investigated, and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on any of these men, contact the Regional Security Office at the nearest U.S. Embassy and the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to rfj@state.gov.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell.
Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.